Welcome to the Animal Voices Radio Show here on 100.5 FM Co-op Radio CFRO in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Today is Friday, May 30th, 2014. I am your host, Allison Cole, and I'm joined here today by my co-host, Cynthia Ganatra.
Hello.
Alyssa, Jackie, and Jenny are away today. Animal Voices is Western Canada's only radio program dedicated to animal advocacy and compassionate living, broadcasting live every Friday from noon till 1 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, and bringing you interviews, commentary, news, and events that you need to keep up to date on what's happening both locally and abroad. In addition to our live broadcast here on 100.5 FM and at cooperadio.org, our shows are also available as podcasts on iTunes and at animalvoices.org after airing. In light of the tragedy that happened a few weeks ago locally, where six dogs perished in the back of a hot truck in Langley, I wanted to bring this issue to attention to educate and empower our listeners on how to prevent this from happening again in the future to your loved ones or to any dog that you may find in a car. Our first interview is with Lori Chorchuk, General Manager of Community Relations of the BC SPCA, and she will be here today to provide information about dogs in hot cars and advice on what to do if you see a dog in a car this summer. And for our feature interview, we have author and CEO of the nonprofit organization Compassion in World Farming, Philip Limbury, on the show today. He has recently published a book called Farmageddon, The True Cost of Cheap Meat, which is an extremely engaging read for which he has traveled the world acting as an investigative journalist to observe and document the systems and effects of global industrial farming. In this interview, he'll tell us about the origins of factory farming and we'll discuss battery cage conditions for chickens, fish farming, veterinarian roles in slaughterhouses, and more. That interview is coming up in about 27 minutes, so please do stay tuned.
Empty the tanks! Empty the tanks! Empty the tanks!
That was a clip from the second annual Empty the Tanks, which was held last Saturday, May 24th, outside the Vancouver Aquarium in Stanley Park. It was the second annual international Empty the Tanks protest that took place in front of captive animal facilities across the globe. The protests were calling for an end of this form of entertainment. It was a public awareness campaign that anyone could have taken part in, and really there was all different types of people there, including many children. It was a family-friendly event with face painting and a mermaid, and our very own Alyssa, one of the co-hosts here on Animal Voices, was doing some lovely face painting. And as I mentioned, there was lots of kids. There was even one kid in a mini playpen, so one of those little playpens that children are in that aren't very big. And she was about, I think, 8 years old. And she had a sign that said, "If I was a dolphin child instead of a human child, would you still buy a ticket?" And she was in there all day. I saw her in there for at least the 2-3 hours I was there. And I spoke to her after, and she was just really cute. She said to me, "I'm like, you've been in there all day." And I'm like, "Can you imagine the belugas spend their lives in, you know, the equivalent of a bathtub for them?" And she's like, "I couldn't even imagine." She's like, "I just spent a few hours in here and I'm exhausted." And yeah, she was just so cute. She was a little vegan kid as well, which was
literally putting yourself in the animal's shoes. And people often don't do that. I think it was a hugely successful event that day. We got a lot of media coverage. Most of the Animal Voices hosts were there, by the way. And I would say 400 people-ish.
Yeah, I think so. At least a few hundred, for sure. And there was, you know, some police presence, of course, and security. And there was actually a couple RCMP officers on horses. And one of the horses took a gigantic poop in front of the Vancouver Aquarium, which I found quite amusing as well.
Quite telling. Now, what was interesting, I found, is we were right in front of the Vancouver Aquarium, like right across the street, because they didn't really want us on their property, even though people were doing that after. But there, we were right in front of where people were actually going to buy tickets. I mean, one of the chants we were saying was, "Don't buy a ticket, don't buy a ticket," and, you know, educate your children, right? And it really, educating your children is to show your children that captivity is not the way to treat others. But I was quite surprised that people were still going to buy tickets, because this was a huge demonstration. Everyone, like most people, were carrying what I thought were really excellent signs with really logical messages on them, you know, so.
And really positive messages, like, if you love them, set them free. And, you know, how would you feel if you lived in a bathtub? And I've been to aquarium, and I think most of us have been. And I think, you know, I always felt like if I went, I was having a connection with these animals, and I always felt like there was something wrong with it. And I didn't know that there's another option. And I think right. that with all these people here and all different types of people, children, adults, teenagers, and holding the signs, I think, you know, maybe if they did buy the tickets, I think we definitely did plant some seeds. And I definitely think once they went into the Vancouver Aquarium and saw those belugas in those tiny tanks, I'm sure their eyes and hearts were open a little bit.
They're probably seeing it in a different way this time, which at least is something. And that was one of the messages from one of the speakers on the megaphone. She was saying, you know, okay, so I understand you're curious, you want to go in, you want to see the whales, the dolphins, but go in with, you know, and looking through it, looking at them through a different lens and really scrutinize and ask questions. And for our listeners out there, if there's anyone who still, you still want to buy a ticket for the aquarium, you know, make it one last time and actually do look at it from a different, I was going to places like these as well until not hugely long ago, you know, and I understand, like, we've all been there and you don't think of it that way. Like, you just don't realize. And I've educated myself so much in the past several years, and I would never go back to a place like that.
And especially the Vancouver Aquarium, which prides itself on being, you know, a rehab and rehabilitation center. So oftentimes people think the Vancouver Aquarium is different than SeaWorld, but that is actually not true. The Vancouver Aquarium does do some good things, but they also do some not good things. And we actually had an interview last week here on Animal Voices with Jeff Matthews, who is the organizer, one of the organizers of Empty the Tanks. And it was a great interview that talked about some of these myths about the Vancouver Aquarium. So you can listen to that podcast on our website. And you can also go to a great website called vanaquafacts.org to learn more about the Vancouver Aquarium and these cetaceans that are held in captivity.
Yeah, so Cynthia, you just got back from an exciting little mini vacation, your vegan trip to Portland. We've all been there, you know, that's the place to go. I was there a couple of months ago, and I want to hear, it was your first time there, I want to hear about what were your highlights of Vegan Haven Portland.
Yeah, so it was my first time, me and my partner, who's also vegan, it was our five-year anniversary, so two vegans, five-year anniversary, what are we going to do? We're going to go to Portland, and it was amazing. We had so many great suggestions by, like, Allison, who gave me an amazing itinerary actually to follow, and some of the other Animal Voices co-hosts, and just people in general. There was just too many options for me to even do in the 4 days we were there. But I made a list of some of my top five favorite eats of the week, of the weekend. So my first was Portobello. Of course, Portobello is the, you know, fine dining vegan restaurant, which was also in the movie that we premiered.
Live and Let Live.
Live and Let Live.
I love seeing behind the scenes in the kitchen.
Yeah, cool. So it was really cool to kind of see that, you know, the other side of it. And my highlight from there was actually the mint chocolate chip ice cream. Before I became vegan, mint chocolate chip ice cream was my favorite. So that was amazing. And of course, the Portobello steak, which of course is not a steak. And the second was a sundae from Back to Eden, which was suggested by Alyssa. It was amazing. It had vegan marshmallows and white chocolate chips, which was just, it was heaven. And my third is actually from a place called Paradox, which isn't a vegan or vegetarian place. But like many of the restaurants in Portland, a lot of them are just so vegan friendly. So I had the frittatas, corn frittatas with a vegan sour cream that they made. Ugh, amazing. And then number four is a cinnamon bun from Blossoming Lotus. The cinnamon bun oozed out delicious, like, apple yumminess out the center. It was just heaven. And my last one, number five, is from The Sweet Hereafter, which is a really cool, funky vegan bar. We had an appy sharing plate, which had an amazing vegan cheese, and it was just a cool atmosphere, really trendy, really funky, and completely vegan, which I loved. And of course, you have to hit up the vegan mini mall, which was awesome. I got myself a herbivore t-shirt, and I went to the Food Fight vegan grocery store, and I got myself some local-made musaman curry paste, which was awesome. So I look forward to making that
vegan. Did you check out Sweet Pea too?
I did. Yeah. I got a donut from Sweet Pea, a cupcake, and something else all in one sitting. It was a bit indulgent, but the best weekend.
Awesome to hear. Thanks for that little report about Portland.
This is your big chance, so don't blow it.
We're here to present the cutting edge radio you want to hear. What about a program featuring just local Vancouver bands?
No market for that.
We have an expert on gospel music.
No.
Our public affairs programs dig deep with voices other stations won't touch.
No.
Programs with First Nations hosts?
Sorry, no market for that.
We've got a lot of shows in other languages for people all over the world. Folk music?
You're kidding, right? who would sponsor that?
Can't make big bucks with programs people want to hear? You have to go to Co-op Radio for that. Community-owned radio. Now at 100.5 FM, the switch is on.
You are listening to Animal Voices here on 100.5 FM CFRO, Vancouver's Co-op Radio in Vancouver in downtown Eastside in unceded Coast Salish territories. So I'm going to go over some events now. The first is actually happening right now from 12 to 1 in Vancouver on Granville in Georgia. It is a PETA demonstration, which is called Try to Relate to Who's on Your Plate. So it's from 12 to 1. So if you're in the area, you can go check it out. Also, next month in June 8th, is the Veg Expo, which is happening on Sunday from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. It's called Vancouver's Everything Vegan and Vegetarian Expo, and it's presented by Hippie Foods. You can discover the benefits of plant-based diet and cooking demonstrations from celebrated local chefs. Sample and discover all products you need to live a healthy lifestyle. It's a day for the entire family with an interactive kid zone, a bodybuilding showcase, tons of free samples, giveaways, and much more. You can visit vegexpo.ca for more info and to buy tickets, which are $15.
And this is the first time that this Veg Expo is being held in Vancouver, so it should be interesting. I'm going, you're going.
Yeah, I'm going, so we're going to check it out, and we're going to do a little review. I know there's some controversy in the vegan community because, you know, their topic is GMOs, so we'll report that back on that in the week after that happens.
It's at Canada Place downtown.
It's at Canada Place, yeah. And then also another aquarium protest, so the grand opening demo at the Vancouver Aquarium. So we didn't really mention, but the Vancouver Aquarium is expanding, so there's going to be a protest, which is being held on Tuesday, June 10th from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. at the Vancouver Aquarium, which is located in Stanley Park. And this coincides with their invite-only grand opening celebration. So in attendance will be local politicians, local media personalities, and aquarium board members, donors, and key supporters. So this is really a great chance to meet these people with our message of compassion, caring, and freedom for these cetaceans. And this note that this this opening gala isn't actually advertised to the public. So many people, they're having a few opening dates, but this is a really important one because this has a lot of, for lack of a better word, movers and shakers who can actually make some change. So they're challenging you to build upon the amazing success of Empty the Tanks. So bring a friend with you who wasn't at Empty the Tanks to keep the momentum going. And of course, you can find information at vanaquafacts.org.
I think it's really important that we get as many people as we can out there just to show the people at the Vancouver Aquarium that we're still here and we still care and we want to empty the tanks.
Exactly, and that there's many of us and it's not just a small group.
Right.
And then also next month, at the end of the month, is the second annual Resistance Ecology Conference from June 27th to June 29th in Portland, Oregon. Yay! The conference is booked at the Portland State University and it's hosted by Resistance Ecology and the Student Animal Liberation Coalition. So it's the second conference and this one will be focused on pragmatic skills and ideas for animal activists looking to get involved in intersectional movement. So they're accepting workshop proposals on a wide range of topics and skill sets. So the first conference, which was 2013, Alyssa went and I reported about it. So,
well, I was just going to say that we actually featured a lengthy interview about the conference last year. So if you want to check that out, I really recommend it. It was a really good interview. Animalvoices.org, and just do a search for Resistance Ecology and you should be able to find it there.
Perfect. Yeah, they had 300 attendees and over 35 speakers and panelists and 30 workshops as well. So amazing. And so people are encouraged to attend, to contribute, and to participate in the second Resistance Ecology conference, which I love. So it's one of these workshop conferences where they encourage, you know, just anybody to come and speak. And there's some people from Vancouver as well. Rising Tides is going to be there from Vancouver. So you can find out more information at resistanceecology.org. And if you have any animal-friendly events for us to air, please send us an email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com or post it in our Facebook page at Animal Voices Vancouver.
Thank you for that. Our first interview is with Lori Chortek, the General Manager of Community Relations of the BCSPCA. She is here today to provide us with tips and knowledge about dogs in hot cars in the summer. Hello, Lori, and welcome to the Animal Voices Show.
Thank you so much.
So a few weeks ago, many dog lovers here locally were devastated to hear the six dogs known as the Brookswood Six who perished in the back of a hot vehicle in Langley. What do dog guardians need to know about keeping their animals in locked cars when they go out for even 5 or 10 minutes?
Well, unfortunately, every year the BCSPCA receives hundreds of calls about dogs in distress in hot cars, because many people don't realize that it can take only 10 minutes in a hot car for an animal to suffer brain damage, organ damage, and even death. Because dogs don't have sweat glands, if they're left in a car, even parked in the shade, windows rolled down, even if you leave a little bit of water, you're still really endangering your pet. So it's such an important message for people to know that even if they're just running in for 5 minutes, that they're putting their beloved pet at risk if they leave them in the car.
And what are symptoms of heat stroke that may occur in dogs, and what should you do if you see these symptoms?
Well, what happens when dogs can't sweat, the heat stays internalized in their bodies. And if you look, you can see they're panting, very exaggerated panting. They have very erratic pulse. If you feel their pulse, they're drooling, salivating, and you can see they become very, very anxious. Once it progresses, you'll see they collapse. There's a lack of coordination. They might be convulsing or vomiting, and then ultimately they just collapse and die. And the sad thing is, I think, is that usually if people are taking their pets with them on errands, it's because they really want to spend time with them. So these aren't bad pet guardians. These are guardians that want to have their animals with them. But I think it's just a lack of knowledge that people don't realize how quickly animals can die in cars. And so we always encourage people, you know, if you love your pet on a warm day or even an overcast day, please leave them at home, because that's the safest place for them.
And it's true that even if you feel that it's not really that hot outside, that the temperatures can really rise dramatically inside the car, right?
Exactly. I mean, cars become ovens, and you know, because when we park cars, we get out of them, so we don't realize how hot they get. But if you are sitting in a locked car for a while, even on an overcast day, even when it's parked in the shade, you realize that the temperature does rise very rapidly in a car, and we're much better able to cope because we have sweat glands. But when dogs have no way of releasing that heat, literally, it's just an oven, and it's a death trap for them.
So I want to empower our listeners to take action if they see a dog in a car in the summer. If you do see a dog in a car on a hot day, what steps should you take to prevent this dog from potentially dying in that car?
Well, the important thing is to act quickly. So we ask people to either call their RCMP, their local police, or they can call the SPCA. We have an animal cruelty hotline. The number is 1-855-622-7722. And people can find that number on our website, which is very easy to find. It's sbca.bc.ca. So please call some enforcement agency that can come and help the animal. And if it's at parked outside a store, we encourage people to go in and see if the store manager will use the pager to page the person to come back with their license plate. And the important thing is to just try to get help for that animal as quickly as possible.
Right. And the SPCA's animal cruelty hotline, it's got certain hours. So outside of those hours, should people be calling 911?
Yes, absolutely. If the hotline is not open in the evening, normally these things will be happening during the day when the hotline is operational, because that's when the sun is the strongest. But if for some reason you can't, always call your police, call your RCMP. It's important that someone responds as quickly as possible.
Well, thank you, Lori, for coming on the show today to speak about what we need to know about dogs in hot cars. For further information about this, please visit the link on our website for today's show at animalvoices.org. Thanks, Lori. Have a good day.
Thank you so much.
You are listening to Animal Voices Radio here on 100.5 FM CFRO Co-op Radio in Vancouver, unceded Coast Salish territories. So I'm going to talk about some news. In the news recently, Jane Goodall has issued a letter calling for the end to whale and dolphin captivity at the Vancouver Aquarium. So the renowned primatologist and founder of the Jane Goodall Institute acknowledges that the Vancouver Aquarium, as an industry leader, noteworthy for pledging not to keep cetaceans caught from the wild, with the exception of endangered species or rehabilitation animals. However, the letter goes on to argue that whale and dolphin captivity of any kind is an outdated practice that should come to an end. Goodall says, the current permission of the Vancouver Aquarium cetacean breeding programs on site and at SeaWorld with belugas on loan is no longer defensible by science. Goodall also states that this is demonstrated by the high mortality rates evident in these breeding programs and the ongoing use of these animals in the interactive shows as entertainment. Goodall suggests there should be a gradual phase out of these marine animals, which is an option that Vancouver activists and civic politicians have described as a realistic means of ending cetacean captivity at the aquarium facility in Stanley Park. The letter also says that the phasing out of such cetacean programs is a natural progression of humankind's evolving view of non-human animal kin. I hope the Vancouver Aquarium and the Vancouver Park Board will be a leader in compassionate conservation on this issue, as you have been as has been done before. You can read all of Jane Goodall's letter online. It's an amazing letter.
I'm curious to know, how did the aquarium respond?
I actually have a response from the aquarium. The Vancouver Aquarium said they have the greatest respect for Jane Goodall, but her information may be incomplete. The current science is clear that beluga whales live as long, if not longer, while in human care. Scientific and behavioral evidence shows that cetaceans at the Vancouver Aquarium are content and thriving, which I think is ridiculous.
That's Cynthia's opinion.
Yes, exactly. Okay. And you can also find other scientists who believe that that is not actually true. And we have also seen, living in Vancouver, that these belugas, baby belugas, have died year and year again after year.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And watch the movie Blackfish if you don't believe us.
Exactly. So also some local news. The BCSPCA, which we just heard an interview from, recommends charges in the death of the six Langley dogs. So the BCSPCA announced this week that it's recommending charges of animal cruelty against the Lower Mainland dog walker after six dogs died in her care on May 13th. Dubbed the Brookswood Six by local media, the dogs were initially reported stolen by the dog walker, but on May 18th, she admitted that the dogs had died after being locked in a vehicle on a hot day. While the SPCA is still completing its report, which will be submitted to the Crown Council within the next few weeks, Marcy Moratri, Chief Prevention Enforcement Officer for the BCSPCA, said enough evidence has been obtained in the investigation so far to warrant recommendations for separate charges for each of the six dogs under the Criminal Code of Canada.
So I have the most exciting news story for my week to share with everyone. As of this week, Panago Pizza is finally offering Day of Cheese on their pizzas. So why is this exciting? You don't seem too enthused, Cynthia.
I just got a dehydrator. I'm trying to go more raw, but I'm going to try this pizza out.
I don't even eat pizza anymore, but yeah, I've got to try this out. Okay, so this is how it all started many, many years ago, like 20 years ago when I first moved to Vancouver and I was young. And I used to treat myself to a Panago pizza once a month. It was my treat. Maybe this was like 15 years ago is where I was living now. And yeah, once a month, I was vegetarian. I wasn't vegan. I used to get like the Primo Veggie, really good pizza. I used to get their pizza over the other ones available because it was the best one and it had the best toppings. And I ate dairy cheese at that time. So when I went vegan years after, I actually ordered a pizza from them with no cheese, and it was pathetic because they barely put anything on it. And so I therefore stopped giving Panago my business and any pizza takeout place, really, until a vegan pizza house came into existence a few years ago, but don't really go there. It's quite far. So Panago delivers everywhere. So that's my story. Oh, and then to add to that is I did write to them and I asked them, please carry Day of Cheese. Otherwise, I can't eat your pizza anymore and I don't eat any anymore. And finally, As of this week, they offer Daya cheese. Their statement is, we're excited to introduce this delicious dairy-free Daya cheese to our menu, plant-based and free of dairy, soy, and gluten. It's a cheese alternative that's full of flavor and holds the stretch and texture of cheese without compromise. So whether you're dairy intolerant, allergic, vegan, or want to try something new, we're on it. Finally, yay. I'm just so excited about that. And they're such a huge company, and I think this says great things about the future of veganizing our nation. So that's all we have for our news. Our feature interview is with Philip Limbury. He is the CEO of the leading farm animal welfare organization, Compassion in World Farming, and also a prominent commentator on the effects of industrial farming. He has recently published an in-depth investigative book called Farmageddon, The True Cost of Cheap Meat, which looks into the many facets of industrial farming around the world and dissects them for scrutiny and consideration. This book discusses the gamut of effects of the industrial farming processes, from animal welfare to health impacts to environmental, political, and economical factors involved. It is extremely well-researched, as is Philip himself. And so we are fortunate to have him here today to speak to us about some of the issues that he raises in the book. Hello, Philip, and welcome to the Animal Voices show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me along.
Well, thank you for coming on the show today to speak with us about your newly released book, Farmageddon, The True Cost of Cheap Meat. I've been reading it wholeheartedly this week and have been taking in a lot of information as a result of your few years of research that it took to put the book together. The subject matter of this book ties in perfectly with your job as the CEO of the organization Compassion in World Farming. Can you start by just telling us a bit about what Compassion in World Farming is and does?
Yeah, Compassion in World Farming is a leading specialist in farm animal welfare. We advocate for a better deal for farm animals. We are campaigning to end factory farming. So we want to bring an end to things like battery cages, where hens are kept in cages so small they can't stretch their wings, veal crates where the calves can't turn around, and gestation crates where the pigs throughout their pregnancy, again, can't turn around. Those systems, we believe, should be banned, and we push for better systems. We want animals to be kept in free-range conditions where they can feel fresh air and sunshine.
And you wrote a whole book about this and a lot more. In the book, at the very beginning, you actually touch upon the origins of how factory farming came to be, which I found really interesting. I wonder if you could expand on that and tell our listeners exactly how and when the world's nations went from raising animals on small family farms to the predominant factory farm model that now exists. This is a piece of important history that I think a lot of people really don't know about.
It all started in the Great Depression in the 1930s, and the U.S., out of for good intentions, passed the first farm bill in 1933, and this was really to help out farmers, particularly corn growers, that were having difficulties, you know, struggling in the marketplace. And the farm bill brought in a subsidy system, a system of subsidy and intervention, which meant that the farmers had a guaranteed market for corn and that any surplus was brought into intervention, into storage by the government. So what this meant was there was no longer any break, any ceiling on production. So corn production went through the roof, and corn became so cheap that you may as well just feed it to animals. And that was the origin of factory farming right there. What then happened was the Second World War came along. And during the Second World War, two things happened. One was there were munitions factories, obviously, churning out weaponry. When the war ended, those munitions factories were repurposed to produce large amounts of artificial fertilizer because the ammonia ingredient was the same. So from bombs to artificial fertilizer, what had also happened is that the Germans, during the Second World War, German scientists had tested new nerve gases on insects for the purpose of killing people en masse. For whatever reason, they did not use those in battle conditions. But after the Second World War, that same technology was used to use the first mass-produced pesticides. So from weapons of mass destruction came the capability for mass production. So that combined with this whole new way of feeding corn, people food, human edible crops to farm animals gave birth to industrial farming, which then started to spread around the world.
Well, thank you for that. It's International Respect for Chickens Month right now, so I would like to talk about the hens who play a major part in providing food to the masses. And you say that you are fascinated with birds and their freedom, so I'm especially interested in hearing your thoughts about the chickens raised for food in today's society. For our listeners who aren't yet aware of battery cages and the conditions they consist of for the chickens, can you first tell us a little bit about those, please, and then impress your thoughts about these battery cages to us?
When I was a little boy, my granddad encouraged me to watch birds, and I became absolutely fascinated. From very early on, I was very switched on and alive to the natural world around me, and particularly the birds and other animals around. And the one thing which really, really blew my mind was the whole idea that little birds or insects or other animals could travel great distances on migration. You know, birds would open their wings and they would leave my hometown in the UK and they would end up somewhere in Siberia. Just was absolutely fascinating. And then by the time I was in my mid-teens, when I was at college, we had an outside speaker came into to our class from an organization I'd never heard of before called Compassion in World Farming. And that speaker, a gentleman called Chris Aston, he told me and my classmates about how our food is produced. He told me about battery cages for laying hens, where the cages are kept in conditions so small they can't even stretch their wings. And they're kept like that for life. And that just set me on a whole new lifetime path. I just felt, you know, these animals that should be free, that should be able to stretch their wings, birds that, you know, in the wild would cover quite some distance, were here spending their whole life standing with less space than you would find on the average sheet of typing paper. And I vowed that that had to change. And by 1990, by the time I was 25, I got a job with Compassion in World Farming, and I joined an organization that had been founded by a farmer, a dairy farmer, an organization that its raison d'etre was to get hens out of cages. And you know what? What I felt was I thought it was a crime. I thought, my goodness, why don't the police get down to those farms and arrest the farmers, get the hens out? That's how I felt then. That's how I feel now. The great news is that in Europe, after 30 years of hard, long campaigning, we've seen those barren battery cages, the tiny cages with nothing but wire, banned throughout the European Union. Unfortunately, we still have what they call the enriched cage, which is not great, but it means that there is some hope. You know, those hens at least have some decency in their life. And the better thing is that many more hens are now being kept in free-range conditions where they can enjoy fresh air and sunshine and stretch their wings. And so that to me is a big deal.
So I know in speaking with people in the industry, you've have mentioned, you know, these chickens are suffering, because that seems to be pretty common knowledge among you and me. But you've been challenged. People have said to you, how do you know that these chickens are suffering? And how do you respond to that?
Yeah, that happened to me in 1994, and it's in the book Farmageddon. What happened was I was on a government committee visit to a new type of cage farm where the cages were just as small for the hens, where they couldn't stretch their wings, but they had perches in them, just a simple perch. And this was supposed to be some kind of revelation. And at the end of being shown around it, I was, you know, gobsmacked that people thought this was a real advance. And I said, all of the reasons why the hens in those cages would suffer. And the government vet who had accompanied the visit said to me, Philip, I agree with much of what you've been saying, but how can you tell me, how can you say that hens suffer? And I thought, my goodness, here is a vet at a government-sponsored welfare committee visit asking whether hens suffer or not. How could I justify that? And I thought, well, one, I could see the irony in that if this guy really didn't think that hens could suffer, why on earth was he on a welfare committee? What would be the point? But the other aspect to this was that it showed how difficult it was to make headway when all too often those who justify factory farming would justify it on the basis of they're only animals and, you know, how do we know they suffer or feel pain anyway? But the big breakthrough came when we got successful campaign one in Europe to get animals recognized as sentient beings, a legal recognition of the fact they could feel pain and suffer. And also, if we let them have feel a sense of joy and well-being. That was in 1997. And I'm so thankful that we won that battle in Europe, because ever since then, there has been no debate about whether hens can feel pain and suffer, because they do, and now the law says so too.
Thank you for that. I'd like to talk about fish now, which is also covered in your book, and I really learned some points about the fishing industry that I didn't know before. When I read statistics of how many animals are farmed each year in Canada or the U.S. or worldwide, these numbers always exclude the fish, so I think they're often forgotten. And they're excluded because, as far as I know, there are no numbers that track how many fish are killed each year for consumption. So without this type of information, I just think that the whole subject of fish farming goes widely unknown. Can you tell us about fish farming and the conditions that the fish are met with in the industry?
Yeah, well, thankfully, the conditions of factory farming on land are becoming better known. And the big problem is too many animals in too small a space. That's what causes the cruelty. That's what causes the environmental problems. That's what causes the disease problems. Well, the sad news is that factory farming is taking to the water and fish farming is proliferating around the world. And the problem with fish farming is pretty much the same thing. Too many fish in too small a space. That is why those fish swim in incessant circles, because they're frustrated in living in a barren environment. That is why the sea conditions, if they're in a sea cage, becomes polluted, because all the muck from those fish carpets and deadens the seabed. That is why you get disease problems. One of the big problems in salmon, for example, is a little thing called sea lice. These are little tadpoles that look innocuous, but they're not. They eat the skin and the scales of the fish, and they can get so bad that they can eat the head of the fish right down to the bone, something known as the death crown. Now, where this becomes even worse is when you have, as is often the case, fish farms located offshore in the mouth of rivers. And so wild salmon that are migrating into the sea swim past these fish farms that can have up to 500,000 fish on them. And if they've got sea lice, the sea lice problem can radiate out. And the wild salmon that have no natural immunity to it, the young salmon can pick up these sea lice, which can, of course, lead to the decline in these little fish.
Also, much of the fish being farmed is actually going to feed farmed animals, which I read about in your book. Can you tell us more about that, please?
Well, what's actually happening is that people think that it takes pressure off the sea if we farmed fish. That couldn't be further from the truth. It takes between 3 and 5 tons of wild fish to produce 1 ton of farmed carnivorous species like salmon, trout, halibut, and cod. And how that works is that, well, when I was doing the research, I traveled to Peru. And the Pacific coast of Peru is a hugely rich, diverse environment with huge stocks of fish, or at least that's how it used to be. Unfortunately, over the last 60 years, industrial fishing of the Peruvian anchovy has led to great declines in that species and the animals and birds that are dependent on them. 60 years ago, people tell me, if you walked out onto one of the seabird islands, the guano islands, where the seabird muck is harvested for organic fertilizer, if you walked out onto one of those islands, the sky would turn black. Such would be the weight of birds. I actually went to those islands as part of the research for Farmageddon, and I walked out and I was heartbroken. It was like a desert. The birds, the seabirds, barely formed a tideline ring around the base of the island. Why? Because the fish that they depend on have been scooped out, ground down into fish meal, and sent to feed factory-farmed fish and other animals in Europe and in China. I was devastated.
Wow. Another interesting topic covered in your book is with regards to the role of veterinarians in the animal agriculture industry, particularly those employed at the slaughterhouses. And this is something that isn't just widely talked about. So I really appreciate you writing this chapter in your book. From your research, what have you discovered to be the reality for the vets who work in the abattoirs?
Well, in general, people look upon vets as the custodians of animal care, the animal champions. Sadly, in places like slaughterhouses, and of course behind the closed doors of a slaughterhouse, animals are at the most vulnerable. What I found is that all too often the veterinarian spends 90% of their time not looking after the welfare of the animals that are being killed, but actually looking at the dead animals, looking at the meat, looking at the meat quality. It's all about hygiene and food safety. There's nothing wrong with that, but hey, you know, if a vet is there to look after animal welfare, then they damn well should be looking after the animals, not looking at dead meat, right? So that really saddened me. And what I also found is that some in the veterinary profession are complicit in supporting industrial farming, in factory farming. Why? Because they sign off on the veterinary drugs, the antibiotics that are used to prop up the bad system. So what is wrong with factory farming? Too many animals in too small a space. That's what causes cruelty. That's what also brings about the disease-ridden conditions. Animals in factory farming conditions would not be able to survive. The system would break down if they were not fed copious amounts of preventative antibiotics. How much antibiotics are fed to factory farmed animals? Well, globally, half the world's antibiotic use is used on farm animals. In North America, that can be as high as 70 to 80% of all antibiotic use is in farm animals. It's no accident that North America just happens to be the most heavily intensive, the most heavily industrialized factory farming of animals worldwide. So I'm not against using antibiotics to treat genuine disease incidents, but using it to ward off disease in a fundamentally unhealthy system is not good for animals. It's not good for people either, because it gives rise to antibiotic-resistant superbugs. And the World Health Organization has now repeatedly said that if we don't do something to cut down antibiotic use in farming and in human medicine, then we could be looking at a post-antibiotic era within a decade where currently treatable diseases will once again kill.
So in the slaughterhouse environment, it's about speed, efficiency, and the bottom line, right? And mistakes happen. It's really difficult to, you know, humanely stun and slaughter so many animals on the line that they need to get through their quota. And you say in your book, the vets, they cannot afford to antagonize their clients by accusing them of cruelty, albeit institutional. To do so would be professional suicide. So it really seems like it's a system that in which they're trapped. They either agree to be part of this system that is just this vicious cycle of not really looking after the animals, or they just decide not to do it at all.
Yeah, I spoke to Jean-Claude Latif, who is a French vet working in a UK slaughterhouse, and he was on the night shift. And what he found was, what he noticed was that there was a problem on the slaughter line. which needed to be dealt with. Some things were too close together. I think carcasses were too close together, which could have meant some disease contamination. And he went to stop the line. He did stop the line, and he was threatened at knife point by a drug-crazed slaughterhouse worker. And that really freaked him out, because not only are the animals behind those closed doors but the most vulnerable, but so are the vets too. So we've got this really, really unhelpful situation. Closed doors, nighttime, people under pressure to kill vast quantities of animals in the shortest possible time. And if the line gets stopped for any reason, then those people in that slaughterhouse can face getting lower money or shorter breaks or both. It's just such an awful situation.
In the book, you have a chapter called $100 Hamburger, and I want to talk about that because it's something that, you know, it comes up on the internet now and then, talking about the true price of meat, but I think most people are unaware of the details involved in that. You reported that Chandra Nair, an Asian environmentalist, has voiced that the price of factory-farmed meat will have to rise dramatically to correct the huge discrepancy between what consumers pay and the real cost of production. So why is the true cost of a $4 burger really more like $100?
Well, what he's getting at there is that we pay for our food three times. So-called cheap meat, you pay across the counter, that's the first time. Then the second time you pay through your taxes that go into the subsidies and other incentives that encourage factory farming. And the third way is through the cleanup cost to the environment and to our health. So just giving you a European statistic, what really amazed me when writing Farmageddon was finding out that 85% of the artificial fertilizers used in Europe are used to grow the feed to feed factory-farmed animals. And the cost of that, the beneficial value of the artificial fertilizer to the agricultural industry is up to 100 billion euros a year. What really astounded me was to find that the cleanup cost, because that artificial fertilizer, that nitrogen, it gets into waterways, into rivers, into lakes, it gets into the air and causes pollution there. We pay in Europe as taxpayers up to 150 billion euros to clean up the environmental problems attributed to that. You know, up to 50% more we pay for our taxes than the entire value to the farming industry.
So you've mentioned governmental farm subsidies, and I'd like to talk about that as well. Can you explain the role that they play in funding the animal agriculture system to allow consumers to pay the cheap prices that they do for meat when they're buying their meat from the grocery stores?
Well, 60 years of government policy and subsidy in the Western world, in North America and in Europe, have gone into encouraging farmers to go down the industrial route, the intensive route. That has led to a distorted marketplace where it's actually harder and less profitable to do the right thing, to farm in a proper way where the animals are kept on the land, and to do it without lots of artificial fertilizer, and to do it without pesticides, and so on. And so what Farmageddon arguing is that we need to reappraise that. We need to have a food system rather than a farming system. And that food system needs to be based on quality food for all, instead of, you know, lots of cheap factory farmed food that actually is bad for the countryside, is bad for our health, and makes it harder to feed a growing little population.
And then in your book, too, you also say it might be cheap at the point of sale, but it comes at a high price to the animals, and that's certainly true.
It comes at a very high price to the animals in suffering. It also comes at a high price to the countryside. It's no accident that over the last 40, 50 years, once common farmland, birds, bees and butterflies have suffered drastic declines in the wake of the industrialization of the countryside. It's also no accident that, in general, food is getting more unhealthy. Meat from grain-fed animals, factory-farmed animals, is higher in saturated fat, lower in omega-3s and other health-giving nutrients. So it doesn't do anyone any favors. And the big irony is that the biggest threat to rural livelihoods and employment in the countryside is industrial agriculture.
So in your travels all over the world, what are the similarities and the differences that you've seen in industrial farming practices? I was actually quite surprised to see that, for example, you travel to Taiwan and Argentina, and they're using factory farming systems there. But I'm interested in knowing the comparisons that you've seen with regards to similarities and differences.
Well, I wanted to see factory farming at its most extreme. And for that, I went to California. I went to California's Central Valley, and we stood amongst vast monocultures of crops, fruits, almonds, every crop imaginable. And when we stood amongst the perfectly regimented rows of trees in the almond groves, I said to my co-author, Isabel Oakeshott, just listen. And you know what we heard? Nothing. Not the chirp of a bird, nor the buzz of a bee. They're all gone. The ecosystem had broken down. We took to the air in a small plane to look at this vast patchwork quilt from up there, and what we saw were things that looked like vicious scars on the landscape. Those were mega dairies, up to 12,000 cows standing on a single muddy paddock, not a blade of grass in sight. I wanted her to see that because that's what some see as a vision of the future. That's what some see as this so-called sustainable intensification. It is not a vision of the future. It is, to my mind, farmageddon. Things are different in Britain and Europe, generally speaking. European farmers are relative novices at industrial agriculture. We still have a lot of our cows and sheep on pasture. You know, sadly, many of our chickens and pigs are still reared indoors, but some of those are outdoors too now and in growing numbers. But there is growing pressure on European farmers to take up American-style hyper-industrialization. And that's why I wrote Farmageddon, because if we don't do something in Europe quickly, then we too could have a countryside that looks more like California, that is peppered with mega dairies and battery feedlots, GM crops, and perhaps animals if we let it. So, you know, the bad news, to my mind, is that U.S.-style agriculture is being exported around the world, and it is uprooting sustainable land-based farms where the animals are kept as they should be, on grass, feeling fresh air and sunshine.
Yeah, you say in your book, with industrial farming often comes an attitude that animals are mere units of production, a means to make a profit. From reading your book, it seems to me like that is a global attitude. What's your take on that?
I think you're right. I think that animals are often just seen as commodities, as goods, as widgets, and factory farming takes that to its natural conclusion. That is why we felt it was so important to get a legal recognition for animals in Europe as sentient beings capable of feeling pain and suffering rather than just goods. And I think that if we are going to be true to ourselves as a civilized society, then we've got to recognize that animals have needs and wants, that they're, what happens to them matters to them, that their lives are their own. You know, they're not just units of food production. And what we can see is that taking that inverse, taking that animals are just goods, are just products, to its natural conclusion of factory farming, brings about its own justice, if you like, that it destroys the countryside, it makes food unhealthy, it turfs farmers off the land, and it helps to make people in poor countries worse off to the point of starvation by failing to recognize and respect the sentience and the intrinsic, the inherent nature of animals. We are doing ourselves a disservice to.
You say that people should be informed about how their food is produced, and they need to remove the blindfold that hinders so many from truly exercising the consumer choice that is their right. You know, we need to exercise our consumer power and not be ignorant about our food. What are your thoughts on that?
Society does not make it easy to be a compassionate consumer. It does not make it easy to exercise our right to choose. And I think that's wrong. I think that what we do need is we need honest labeling. We need labeling which is absolutely clear about how the meat, milk, and eggs are produced. And until we get that, we are going to be hampered. We are going to be like shoppers with blindfolds. We're not going to be able to exercise our choice, and that is wrong.
Well, thank you so much, Philip, for coming on the show today to speak with us about some of the findings in your new book, Farmageddon, The True Cost of Cheap Meat. To find out more about the work that Philip does at Compassion and World Farming, please visit the website ciwf.org.uk. And I do encourage people to go out and get the book, Farmageddon. It's a really, really interesting read. Thank you, Philip. Have a good day.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
You've been listening to the Animal Voices show on 100.5 FM CFRO, Vancouver's co-op radio, broadcasting live in the downtown east side in Vancouver in unceded Coast Salish territories. Please join us next week. That's June 6th for another great show. We'll be having a show about World Oceans Day. And if you enjoyed the show and want to keep connected with us, you can do so by signing up to our Facebook page, which is Animal Voices Vancouver. And you can join us on Twitter at Animal Voices YVR, and please do send us your suggestions and comments about the show either on Facebook or via email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. Also check out our website at animalvoices.org, where our shows can be downloaded from. And we're also going to be rebroadcasting on Tuesdays. What time on Tuesdays?
Alternating Tuesdays starting next week at noon, same time. So if you want to get someone connected with our live broadcast, kind of live on the radio, you can check us out there, 100.5 FM.
Cool. And we are volunteers here, so if you appreciate the work we do here in Animal Voices, you can donate to us via the Co-op Radio website and just click donate to Co-op Radio. And remember to make a donation towards Animal Voices. And if you're living in Canada, your donations are tax deductible for any amount donated over $25. So we are closing with My Best Friend, the Dog Song by Heidi Winzinger. Stay tuned now for Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith. Thank you so much for listening to Animal Voices today, and remember to be kind to the animals.
La la, la la, la la, la la, la la, la la, la. Hey there, my little dog, would you like to go outside and play with me? Twiddledee. I told you lately.